listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Tonight's program with Eliza Griswold and Amir Hussein is part of the Aloud Interfaith Series, which is funded by the Righteous Persons Foundation, whom we are deeply grateful to for making this program possible. Today's LA Times review of Eliza Griswold's book called The Tenth Parallel, A Richly Textured Fugue That Dramatizes the Dizzying Interplay Between Notions, Faith, Morality, Identity, and Nations. Eliza Griswold's point of observation, the tenth parallel, is the line of latitude 700 miles north of the equator, where more than half of the world's 1.3 billion Muslims live, as do 60% of the world's 2 billion Christians. And to report on relations between Christianity and Islam, Griswold spent 7 years traveling in Nigeria, the Sudan, Somalia, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines. And that doesn't mean that she traveled that whole time in an air-conditioned town car. Believe me, in Nigeria, she floated on a rusted oil barrel to reach a Christian woman stranded with her children by a flash flood. And in the Philippines, by boat down the tributaries of the Linguazan Marsh to meet the most powerful commander of the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. Griswold is the daughter of an Episcopal bishop, or otherwise known as a preacher's kid. She's not only an intrepid reporter, she's an award-winning poet. She's a recipient of a 2010 Rome Prize from the American Academy in Rome, and her first book of poems, Wide Awake Field, was published in 2007. She was a Nineman Fellow at Harvard University, and she's currently a fellow at the New America Foundation. And in conversation with Eliza tonight, we have Amir Hussein. We're very happy to have him here. He's professor of theological studies at Loyola Marymount University, where he teaches courses on Islam and world religions. His most recent book is Oil and Water, Two Faiths, One God, An Introduction to Islam for a North American Audience. And from 2011 to 2015, he'll be the editor of the journal The American Academy of Religion. So our format for tonight is a conversation between Amir Hussein and Eliza Griswold, after which we will open to your questions. We'll have two microphones circulating in the audience, and we ask that you wait until one comes to you, as we do record for a podcast. And after that, please join us for the book signing in the lobby and the reception. And now please join me in welcoming Eliza Griswold and Amir Hussein to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you all for being here. Saying to Eliza backstage, I have a charmed life. You know, the privilege of being able to sit here and have this conversation with someone who I've admired for years. I came to know Eliza's work through Harper's. I subscribed to Harper's Magazine in 2003. There was this wonderful, wonderful article about the Taliban. And then a couple years later, an article about Maoist rebels in Nepal by the same person, Eliza Griswold, and I thought, this is someone I might want to keep track of, you know, because she's hanging out with the Taliban and she's hanging out with Maoist rebels in Nepal. And then she wrote this amazing piece in, it was 2006, you know, about American Gulag, you know, about our treatment of prisoners and where that comes in. And then this book came out, Wide Awake Field. And I was saying to Eliza that I came to the study of theology through the study of English literature. I did all my work at the University of Toronto and learned Shakespeare from Northrop Frye, you know, one of the great English scholars in North America. And Professor Frye's book, The Great Code, begins with this line in the subtitles of the Bible and literature. And he begins, "A sacred book is normally written with at least the concentration of poetry so that, like poetry, it is closely involved with the conditions of its language." Poets tell the truth about the world, and it's odd to do this, but let me read one of Eliza's poems. I mean, it's odd because she's sitting here, and hopefully she'll read one of her poems at the end. But this is a poem from Wide Awake Field called Authority. The flaming city makes it rain. The siege has changed the weather. We lie together on the luggage. The generator that won't work. A poisoned rice sack. This is so many years ago and 15 seconds. I'm embarrassed to remember the time before I grew uncertain about you, or that I had a right to say where I had been and what I saw there. It's those lines, where I had been and what I saw there. You know, that's what Eliza's done in the 10th parallel. For those that aren't familiar with the book, Eliza, would you talk a little bit about the 10th parallel and what the 10th parallel is and your experiences there?
Sure. So the 10th parallel, I think it probably comes from about third grade. In my head, lat is flat. So latitude is horizontal. So we have the equator, and then we have the line of latitude 700 miles to the north, which is the 10th parallel. Up? Okay. Like that? Is that good? Okay. So in the 700-mile-wide band, which is from West Africa through Southeast Asia, Christianity and Islam largely meet due to wind and weather and centuries of human migration. And I really began traveling along this bandwidth with the single statistic that 4 out of 5 of the world's 1.3 billion Muslims do not live in the Middle East. They're not Arabs, they're Africans and Asians. And I wanted to travel with so much of this sort of oversimplified notion of a clash between civilizations. I wanted to travel where Islam actually physically met with Christianity, because about a little less than half of the world's 2 billion Christians also live along this line. And I wanted to see what happened when the two met in flooded fields, in droughts, in elections, sometimes in cacao fields, fighting over, really wrestling over when the world's chocolate prices spiked. So did violence on the island of Sulawesi in Indonesia, as Christians and Muslims began to vie for very expensive land. So I wanted to see what actually happens when these religions meet, away from the sort of overblown nonsense that we hear in sound bites on the news.
And that's where this book is so powerful. And I want to talk with Eliza a little bit about that, the different places that she's traveled to, you know, Nigeria, the Sudan, Somalia, Malaysia, the Philippines, and contextualizing that. But I had no idea until, you know, I read this, that you were Frank Griswold's daughter, the Episcopal bishop, which leads to probably, you know, in some ways the most interesting part of the book, that there you are at the table with Franklin Graham, the Billy's boy, and Omar Hassan al-Bashir, the dictator in Sudan. How's that happen?
So Franklin Graham in 2003 in the fall was invited to Sudan, to northern Sudan, where he'd never been, to meet with still today Sudan's president, President Bashir, who is the only sitting president who stands indicted for war crimes by the International Criminal Court for his actions in Darfur. And before Darfur, he had declared the modern world's bloodiest jihad against Christians and Muslims alike in his own country. And this was over 2 decades. And so Darfur was just beginning to heat up. There were rumors of it. Human Rights Watch was beginning to talk about it. But it was certainly not in the scope of Franklin Graham, who wanted to go to Sudan to ask President Bashir for the right to proselytize among Muslims, which has been illegal for the past 100 years since the Brits split Sudan on the 10th parallel in 1904, because the British had faced a large Islamic rebellion in the north of the country in the late 1800s, and then they had they had actually been defeated. It was very shaming, and they'd faced this large public defeat at the perceived hands of Islam. They came back, they took over Sudan, Africa's largest country, and they said, if we don't want more trouble with Muslims, we are not going to let missionaries try to convert them. So guess what, missionaries? You guys are going south of the 10th parallel, and you're not coming north of it. So this divide between North and South Sudan, which we're starting to hear a lot about now again, as South Sudan will have the right to vote, hopefully, for its own independence this January, this divide is, you know, a century old. It's led to 4 decades of civil war and the death of about 2 million people. Franklin Graham has worked with in the South among Christians and non-Muslims in the South. And his views of Islam were very much shaped by his experience of watching President Bashir's practices. Now, in 2003, Graham was most famous or infamous for calling Islam a very wicked and evil religion. And so for him to go to a Muslim land at the invitation of the president was hugely controversial. And it was in Bashir's interest to have him come because Bashir was terrified that after Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan would become the third rogue Muslim regime on America's hit list. And the best way for him to safeguard his country was to invite powerful evangelical leaders, especially those close to President George W. Bush. And Franklin Graham was George W. Bush's personal pastor. So when I understood what this meeting was to entail, I asked if I could go along. And we sat in Bashir's waiting room, and finally we were ushered into the de facto throne room. And the two men very quickly attempted to convert one another to their respective faiths. That did not go very well. And then something really... Bashir speaks English, but he did not speak in English during this interview. He spoke only Arabic, but he wouldn't, when English was spoken to him, when Graham spoke to him, he wouldn't wait for the translation to kind of show everybody he understood, right? He uttered one sentence, actually a question in English, in the course of this interview, which is Graham turned to him and said, you know, Mr. President, I run the largest hospital in southern Sudan. And it's in a place called Louis. And Bashir turned to his aide and said in English, isn't that the hospital we bombed? And Graham said, twice, and you missed. At that point, most of us were ushered out of the room. And what ensued, Graham told me later, was that he, as he said it, I'm just going to repeat what he said, he remembered at this moment that he had a George W. Bush 2004 re-election pin in the pocket of his blue blazer. So he reached into his blazer pocket and pulled out the pin and handed it to Bashir and said, Mr. President, I understand you'll be speaking to my president later today. Why don't you tell him you're his first voter here in the Sudan? And so what was that about? That was really Graham's not-so-tacit indication that he was extremely close to the U.S. government. And here is, for me, it was a huge lesson in how faith and foreign policy work together in ways that we may not know how our leaders send leaders out who represent us and why it is, especially we're seeing this today, why it is the West is believed to be Christian. Because we sit here and think, why is the Christian West? What's that about? Well, because many, you know, until recently, most of the world's aid work was certainly done by missionaries. And the legacy of that is extremely strong. And in the book, I came across the fact that the Young Men's Muslim Association, which is a precursor in many ways to the Muslim Brotherhood, was founded in direct competition and in response to the Young Men's Christian Association, YMCA. Because here were missionaries doing health, hygiene, and scripture. And the Muslims, especially in Egypt, where they'd gone, said, we can do the exact same thing. Thank you very much. So all of these interlinkages are fascinating to me. So maybe, sure. So after Franklin Graham came back, after we left the palace, he held a prayer meeting for Christian leaders, Sudanese Christian leaders. And during this meeting, I was reporting for Vanity Fair, hardly a bastion of Christian values, but so I was standing in the back of this sort of outside a prayer circle, and I had my notebook, and when Graham said, "Let us pray," my response was to lower my head and pray alongside, and that raised eyebrows among his own people, because they thought, well, who is this person, and why would she? So I'm going to read to you what happened next. So in the hallway a few minutes after the prayer meeting, Ken Isaacs, Graham's second-in-command, a tall, hard-jawed North Carolinian who would go on to head the Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance under President Bush, approached me and asked, "What's your background?" "Originally, I came from Philadelphia," I told him. "That's not what I meant," he said. Was I a believer or not? Salvation was absolute. Saved or damned, there was no in-between, which was I. To me, the question required a more complex answer. I was raised as the daughter of an Episcopal priest, and I grew up in a rectory in suburban Philadelphia during the 70s and 80s, a particularly progressive moment for the church. Worship included Passover Seders, Jesus Christ Superstar, and doing the crop hunger walk, as well as gathering around an altar and eating homemade organic wheat bread at the Eucharist. This was the bustling, clamorous world of public religion. Talking and listening to God involved a quiet conversation, and words, I was sure, were the way to reach his ear. For me as a 6-year-old girl, going out to play often meant sneaking next door to the dark, cool church. I learned to read by standing at the pulpit and practicing the Bible's cadences out over the empty pews. I saw the Bible, sitting open on the brass lectern, a red satin ribbon marking the page, as a book of spells, one whose extravagant metaphors, whose terrible and powerful parables, were ways to call God down to earth. In college, 15 years later, I read the work of the 20th century Romanian historian and theologian Mircea Eliade. When I came across his concept of hierophany, the spaces where the sacred and secular worlds meet and people's attempt to create them through ceremony, I understood what I had been up to as a child. At Sunday school, a boy my age once asked me if my father was God. No, he's God's best friend, I replied. I saw my loving, distant, distractible father caught between two worlds. One was a place of worldly decisions and unexpected telephone calls. Once I watched him rip the rectory's black rotary phone right off the wall. The other was a sacred realm in which he was a servant, not a leader. When I was 12, he was elected the Episcopal Bishop of Chicago, and so we moved from a Philadelphia suburb to the urban shore of Lake Michigan. At his consecration, the rite in which a person formally offers himself or herself to God as a bishop, my father, following long tradition, lay face down on the cathedral floor with his legs extended and arms outstretched, his body forming the shape of a cross. There was something about this act of utter surrender that terrified and angered me. What right had God and several thousand Midwestern strangers in the pews to demand my father's life? When are they going to let Dad up? I asked my mother. Although I feared for my father, I also feared for myself. What did God want from us anyway? As a teenager, I grew petrified of God's will. What if he were to swoop down and ask me to submit also? What could faith cost me? It could cost me myself, I concluded. Frankly, I was afraid God would ask me to be a nun. My father's uncompromising commitment to the articles of his faith proved difficult for me to reconcile with his progressive values and his critical intelligence. I spent those years wondering how it was that faith and intellect could coexist. When I traveled with Franklin Graham to Sudan 16 years later, my father was serving as the presiding bishop. The consecration of Jean V. Robinson had just taken place, upsetting not only African bishops, but also American evangelicals such as Graham, with the blessing it obviously conferred on homosexuality. This was evidence to them of the lethal moral lassitude of the West, where whole churches were bent on denying God's will as revealed by Scripture. For Graham, the contemporary confrontation with Islam was sharpening the Christian faith, giving it moral fortitude. Western sinfulness and moral slackness were weakening the faith worldwide, and Christianity needed the West to shape up if it was going to win this fight. But for Graham, as for others, the consecration of Gene Robinson as the Bishop of New Hampshire was not just a sign of weakness, a falling away from the old true faith. It was a full-on repudiation of the sexual morality that some believed set them apart. As such, It marked a divide among Protestants worldwide over what it meant to be a Christian, over whether progressives or conservatives had the right to speak in the name of God. The Reverend Franklin Graham and Presiding Bishop Frank Griswold stood on opposite sides of this divide, and the gap between them was widening, and I was the Presiding Bishop's daughter. "You have 30 seconds to tell Franklin," Isaac said. Graham was in the dining room eating a lunch of oxtail soup with 12 members of his entourage. In the doorway, I hesitated. 13 seconds, Isaac said, standing behind me. I sat down at the table and told Graham who my father was. Graham listened, then looked at me and flashed a smile. Not the familiar high-wide public beam, but a private and mischievous grin. He and I were kin, for although we were raised with very different understandings of what it meant to be a Christian, we were also fellow PKs or preacher's kids, mottled sheep who had grown up caught between religious parents and private rebellion. But that's where our similarity ended. As far as he was concerned, the fact I had not accepted Jesus Christ as my personal Lord and Savior meant I was going to hell. "There is no middle ground. Salvation is black and white," Graham told me. He had made this choice for Christ himself. Why hadn't I? I asked him to clarify. What did he mean by praying to Jesus? How was that different from praying to God? The clatter of soup spoons ceased. Graham looked at me and said, "Jesus is the only one who died for our sins. Muhammad didn't do that. Buddha died, still searching for truth." He quoted what I later learned was the gospel according to John, chapter 14, verse 6. "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." There was only one way to be saved and to be assured a place in heaven, through faith in Jesus Christ. "If your plane crashes tomorrow," he asked me, "are you absolutely sure you'll go to heaven?" I thought for a moment. "No." "Would you be willing to pray with me now?"
Thank you. One of the things I was going to go on a different tangent with missionaries, and we'll come back to that. But one of the many, many things I love about your book is, and you identify this very early on, page 13, the struggle within religions. You know, I teach a course on world religions, and the phrase I repeat over and over again to my students is, if you're going to learn one thing in this course, it's that there's no one way to be anything. You know, we talk about the diversity between religions, and in some ways that's easy. How are Christians different from Muslims? What about within? And how are Christians different from each other? So how does, you know, the Episcopal Church with Gene Robinson, an openly gay, not just a priest but a bishop, how does that go over with Franklin Graham? And you know, the differences within Christianity. And one of the things that, again, I love about the book is, as you point out, the differences within Islam. You know, are there things there that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, the central takeaway, as one might say, of the book for me is that the most overlooked and important religious clashes of our time are those inside of, not between religions. And, you know, what that passage I just read is a complete indication of that, that, you know, it's a wrestle. We see this at ground zero. I mean, most recently, Franklin Graham was in the news for calling President Obama not a true Christian, essentially, for saying he was born a Muslim, right? So I called Franklin up and I said, well, what did you mean by that, right? Because one of the things he claims is to stand outside of politics, right? Politics are dirty. There are fundamental truths of the faith. They are not political. And I said, that sounded a lot like politics. And he said to me, he said, first of all, I should have said perceived. And I thought, okay. And he also said, he told me a story of what Obama, that when the president was running for president, he had a conversation with Graham and told Graham how it was he came to become a member of Reverend Jeremiah's church. And Graham was not satisfied that he had made a true, that he had truly given his life to Christ, which for Graham is essential to being a true Christian. So, you know, this wrestle at ground zero over what should happen is really a wrestle between Graham over what is he a true Christian? Is Obama a true Christian? How wide is that tent? And why is it getting so narrow?
Yeah, and you know, the president, it was this weekend, I guess, was talking about being Christian by choice, I think exactly in response to those comments. And I Louise mentioned earlier that one of my hats is I'm the editor of the Journal of the American Academy of Religion. The American Academy of Religion is the largest academic organization for the study of religion in North America. And our annual meeting in 2008, the election, was in Chicago. And we were literally in the same hotel the day before Obama was going to be in that same hotel, and the suite that was used for the American Academy of Religion sort of shindigs up at the top floor was the thing that Obama was going to be in, looking out over Grant Park. And it was a very weird feeling, like literally knowing the next day the next person in this room looking out in this view is going to be the next president of the United States, you know. And I happened to be in Notre Dame in South Bend giving a talk that day. And I so wanted him to come out in Grant Park with Michelle in hijab and just say, Salaam Alaikum, you know. He would have been shot, so I know why he didn't do it. But, you know, just this sense that somehow to be a Muslim, well, you can't be president, you know, if you're a Muslim. But then the internal debates there, you know, what does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to accept Jesus? You know, are you really not a good Christian because you're not prepared? You
know? Totally. No, I mean, I actually, you know, one of the things about reading that passage is that the book is very much not a memoir, and that's probably the most personal passage in it. But on occasion, when these matters of theology come up, I dial my father's number and say, Dad, can you just run me through what United Church of Christ, like, what is the confession of sins? What has Obama done? And he's like, he's done absolutely everything Franklin Graham has done, just with different terms, slightly different terms. So why is it that this exclusivity, I mean, what we're seeing both within Islam and within Christianity and have for probably about 3 decades, 2.5 decades, are these massive revivals.
Absolutely.
Right? This upsurge in people's desire to have a personal relationship with God. And that is extremely exciting and extremely diverse, and it can be dangerous when the understanding is that, well, now I have a personal relationship with God. I can read this holy text and I can tell you what it says without any kind of mediation. So it's totally unmediated. And do you know how I know it's true? Because it's the literal word. And so that sort of, one of the questions I began with when I started this reporting is, does fundamentalism inherently lead to violence? Because if there's one true way, then every other way is sinful at best, evil at worst. And so that binary thinking, you know, saved, damned, black, white, good, evil, will it always lead us to perceive the other as lesser?
And that, and it really is that good and evil. I mean, that's one thing I remind my students that, you know, in theological language, the opposite of good is not bad. The opposite of good is evil. And you look at those kinds of questions, and you know, it goes back centuries. If you look at, for example, the Wahhabi movement in Saudi Arabia that begins to drive the foreigners out and to purify the religion from within, that's seen as this sort of really deviant form of Islam. The foreigners that they're trying to drive out aren't the British. They're the Turks. You know, it's an internal Muslim question that these people aren't Muslim enough, aren't the right kind of Muslim.
Exactly. And to that point, this Islamic rebellion that the British put down eventually with the help of the Maxim gun began as a contest inside of Islam. This Mahdi, this self-appointed savior of religion, was rising up against the Turks, against the oppression of fellow Muslims, not imperialists. It just became very convenient to slide that ideology over to the British.
Yeah, and it comes over. I talked about the missionary thing, and that one of the things that really stands out in your book is the nuances there. Because I look at myself, you know, I was born in Lahore in a Catholic missionary hospital. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that's why 40 years later I ended up in a Catholic Jesuit university. You know, it's once in, never out. You know, they sort of get you somehow. But, you know, this was absolutely wonderful. I'm delighted that I was born, delivered in the world by a nun, Sister Elizabeth, you know, who had no sense at all of, you know, you must convert your child or you must become a Christian or anything like that. It's, you know, there are women in this place, Lahore, that need medical care. I'm there to offer that. And to me, that's the best face of the missionary enterprise. But you see not so nice faces and you talk about them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that was one of the central challenges was to never flatten any kind of massive category into generalization. And that is particularly difficult to do in terms of mission work, because when the British came back to Sudan and when colonial powers really put their roots down in central Africa along the 10th parallel, some of the missionaries who came along with them, missionaries came with armed with the two Bs, right? The Bible and the bicycle. Some missionaries came explicitly targeting the 10th parallel as the place to stop Islam, because essentially this is as far south, the 10th parallel is as far south as Islam had reached by the 1800s because of tsetse flies. This is where, if you picture Africa as a sock, as kind of a Christmas stocking, is my sort of easiest, and you think of the uppermost third as the dry north, desert essentially. Where the desert ends and the wet south begins, that band, this is the 10th parallel. So where the wet south begins and tsetse flies begin, so does sleeping sickness. And that sleeping sickness killed off the camels and horses that the Muslim traders and missionaries were using, that they were riding to carry the faith south. So when colonial powers came in, there's one missionary in the book in particular, his name's Carl Kuhn. He is a piece of work. This man decided he was going to build a series of missionary forts along the 10th parallel to stop Islam. And that's reading through these archives that of his Sudan United missions, because I would go do a little bit of reporting and then I would learn what the church that he founded is now one of the absolute most violent in Nigeria. And their understanding is very much that they need to hold this fault line along the 10th parallel again for the world against Islam. You know, you think, we know September 11th, we had it much earlier, and, you know, this kind of thinking. And I said, well, where did you guys get that? And we said, well, we got it a century ago from Carl Kuhn, the missionary who founded our church. So I actually went back into Lamont Library, because I was at Harvard at the time, and dug through, there happened to be, these archives were there. And here was this language that could have come out of the mouth of those like Franklin Graham. I mean, this kind of imperialist Christianity thinking that is so dangerous and so polarizing. So that was interesting.
And you know, again, one of the many things I love about the book is that no one gets off easy there, you know, and you're not afraid to call people on the things that they've done. And you know, you always sound apologetic when you say this as a Muslim and someone who's a Muslim who teaches about Islam. But, you know, the perception is that it's Muslims that are doing violence, that Christians, of course, don't do violence,
right?
Because, of course, Jesus turned the other cheek, and therefore there's no violence in Christianity. And, you know, my Jewish friends of a certain age, you know, have a different story to tell.
Mine too.
Yeah. But Nigeria, you look at the conflicts there, and there are horrible things that Muslims have done to Christians. There are horrible things that Christians mm-hmm. have done to Muslims. And again, what I love about this is it's not taking sides. It's looking at that. But there's also hopeful experiences.
Sure. Sure. To a word as to why, I mean, Christianity along this fault line is particularly militaristic sounding, because the people who live along this fault line were historically ethnic minorities who, before Christianity arrived, were frequently enslaved by their Muslim neighbors. And this is, so Balada Sudan, that name, the land of the blacks, is really an Arabic term marking this line, this fault line where the black south of Africa began and people could be slave raiders rode through here. And so when Christianity came, for many people, Christianity became really a form of liberation and a weapon. Because here, finally, they had an ideology with a collective identity, a shared sense of theology, and a way to fight back. So that's one reason why a lot of the language is so, and why there are many instances where they perpetuate violence, because they are terrified to be minorities, and they are holding this line. That's some of how these things land, ethnicity, everything becomes interwoven. There are tons of hopeful signs, and we'll just stay in Nigeria with one of these guys.
Talk about that, man.
So there's a pastor whose name is James Wuwe. He belongs to one of these groups that used to be before Christianity. He was belonged to something called a hill tribe, and these guys literally took to the hill to outrun Muslim slave raiders, and so they became warriors. His ethnic group, his ancestors were warriors. So he adopted Christianity, his parents did before him, and he became the leader of essentially a Christian army. And he has one arm because the other was lopped off in fighting with the local imam who had a Muslim army. So these guys, about 15 years ago, were involved in a fight over a particular market because there's always a secular trigger to all of this, right? So here's this market these guys are fighting over. The pastor loses his arm, and the two today are working together with some of the most effective interfaith work I've ever seen. And where I have seen interfaith work to be successful is when there's an introduction of a third element. So when guys sit down and say, I believe this, really, I believe this, you know, I grew up around a lot of that. I've not seen it to be particularly effective. But, you know, what these guys do is they say, you know what? These Christian and Muslim women in this town, their kids are fighting over firewood, violently fighting over firewood because there's not enough fuel because they've cut down all the trees. So how are we going to get them to work together? Let's work out these stoves. Here are these low wood-burning stoves. They cost about $100. The pastor and the imam can't pay for them. So they go to these women and say, guys, here are these stoves. It'll cost you a third of what it costs you to pay for. About a year's worth of wood costs $365, about $1 a day in northern Nigeria. Here's a stove. It's going to cost you one third of that. But how are you going to raise that money? So work together and figure it out. So it's the introduction of that third element that I've seen as so successful.
Oh, absolutely. One of my sort of colleagues and mentors is this wonderful man named Derek Evans, who in the 1990s was the Deputy Secretary General of Amnesty International. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the people that was instrumental in negotiating the peace accords in Sri Lanka. And you've got, mm-hmm. you know, in this case, it's neither Christians nor Muslims. It's Hindus and Buddhists, mm-hmm. you know, the Tamils and the Sinhalese. And if you start talking about land, that's not going to work. And, mm-hmm. and so Derek, in his genius, says, so what are we going to do with the garbage? Who's going to pick up the garbage? Because, of course, in that part of the world, you know, people live off mm-hmm. off of this. Who picks up the garbage? Who gets to use the garbage? That's an important question. Mm-hmm. Within a couple of days, you've got other things settled. But mm-hmm. it really is that. I mean, I think you need to have that background mm-hmm. information. But you have to engage in things. And to me, that's where interfaith dialogue, and I'm, again, very privileged as a Muslim teaching in a Jesuit institution, where the notion is service.
Yes.
You know, we both agree, as Muslims and Christians, that our duty is to help the needy. Well, how do we do that? Mm-hmm. You know, who are the needy in our community? How mm-hmm. do we go out and do those kinds mm-hmm. of things?
I'm thinking, Amir, there's a kind of lunatic high roller pastorish man who in southern Nigeria, in Lagos, who's founded a religion called Chrislam, and I'm thinking maybe we should go. And I'm seeing that he may have two new adherents. Maybe we should start Chrislam West.
A chapter here.
Exactly.
But again, and you look at those similarities, because when I heard you reading those words from John's Gospel, and I use that sometimes in class to say, look, as a Muslim, I believe that Jesus is God's prophet. I believe that Jesus is born of Mary, who was a virgin, which some of my Christian friends, it's like, really? You believe that?
Totally.
Like, I don't
totally.
Believe that,
totally.
And I'm a Christian. But then that whole sense of that Jesus points the way to God.
Absolutely.
You know, it's really interesting kinds of things. So I read that very differently than Christians do. But
absolutely.
It's that diversity.
No, I mean, one of my favorite stories that I came across when I was reporting the book is that when the Prophet Muhammad, and please correct me because I would love to get this exactly right, that I think would it have been he 622 about 632 possibly
632 is when he dies. So
okay, so he the date that I think is right is 615 that he gets cast out of Mecca.
That's Abyssinia when he moves. Towards
Okay, so sure. One of was I in Ethiopia yet? I came across this incredible story that when Muhammad had to flee his hometown of Mecca and go about 210 miles away to the city of then Yathrib, which we now know as Medina, the Prophet city. He sent his dearest, about a dozen of his dearest followers and his own daughter, Rukia, to Africa, to what's today Ethiopia, to the court of a Christian king, the king of Abyssinia. And this is one of the earliest cases of political asylum. And what he and his followers said, you know, we are going to the king. Let us tell you the story of the Virgin Mary's birth. And I mean, Virgin Mary giving birth to Jesus beneath a date tree. And that this Christian king was so touched by this story that he gave the Muslims land in a place called Nagash, where I was a few months ago. And they're still the descendants of these first followers. So just restoring that history and that shared history is so important.
And part of that is the whole question of majority minority. Are you the dominant? Are you the minority? You know, and I point this out all the time to my Muslim friends that look, if you look at the very first encounter between Muslims and Christians, as Muslims and Christians, not individuals but as a community, it's that thing, the emigration to Abyssinia, where Muhammad sends his followers, knowing that it's a Christian country, knowing that they will be protected. You know, it's really interesting, and part of that debt, and you know, use that term that, you know, Muslims owe to Christians, but except we forget those kinds of things. You know, when we're in the position of dominance and authority, what do we do?
Absolutely.
We've got a few minutes here before we go to the questions. We've talked a little bit about Nigeria and the Sudan, but again, one of the things that I really like about your book is that you talk about the breadth of the 10th parallel. You know, we're almost sold a bill of goods that there's this sort of generic, homogeneous Muslim violence, as if the issues in Somalia and Sudan are the same, or if the issues in Nigeria are the same as in Somalia, or Nigeria are the same as the Philippines or Indonesia. But I love the book because you talk about the dominant face, if you will, of Islam is an Asian face. If you look at the majority of the world's Muslims, they're not Arab. They're Asian. The country with the most Muslims is Indonesia. It has its own issues, but those are different. And could you talk a little bit about maybe Indonesia or Malaysia or the Philippines? I mean, those are chapters in the book.
Sure. So one of the patterns in which how Christianity and Islam came to meet in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, is really that where these two kinds of land meet, two kinds of wind meet, that dry air dropping from the north and wet air rising from the south collide near the equator, depending on the time of the year, to the north or south. That's the trade winds. These are the patterns that drive the trade winds. So these winds dropped Christian and Muslim traders and missionaries on the same beaches, in the same islands, in the same ports, where they came during the spice trade to fight over what was cloves now, then, right? Wrestle over these trade routes and now can look like chocolate or political elections or whatever. And Hindus and Buddhists before them, right? So this is centuries. It's like a liquid patchwork of woven currents of cultures. So what happened in the Eastern Archipelago so Indonesia is it's about 24,000 islands, right? And it's 240 million people, about 90% of them are Muslim. When people ask me, are Islam and democracy compatible? You just say, look at Indonesia. They're functioning right there. But what the Dutch did, particularly when they came in as a colonial power in the eastern part of this archipelago, Islam had already reached the coasts of these islands in the east, and because of trade, right? So the staple protein for the Muslims was fish. And the Dutch, very quickly, missionaries understood that they had an advantage if they went inland, because the people who lived inland, it was the same kind of minority-majority thing going on, that the people who lived inland were ethnic minorities, and they didn't eat fish because they had no access to the sea. They ate pork. They ate wild boar. And the missionaries, the Christian missionaries, understood that since pork is forbidden under Islam, and these people weren't going to become Muslims, they had an advantage. They could eat pork and be Christians. So if you look at the pattern of religious, if you take an aerial view and look at some of these islands, what you see is kind of a bullseye pattern today. You see a Christian inland and a Muslim coast to this day. So that is one of the sort of geographic ways in which Christianity and Islam have been rooted in Indonesia. But One of the most exciting and hopeful signs of the book comes from Indonesia, and I think we're starting to see it here, which is, you know, in this massive, largely functioning, really messy, but largely functioning democracy, there was a time when radicals within Islam had a greater, they own more of the airwaves than they do now. But what we're starting to see is the majority, that so-called silent majority, push back and say, you guys don't speak for me. You don't speak for my God. You're not going to mediate your social codes in my country. And we've seen this pushback, this kind of, it's a, one of those splintering, those fault lines inside of Islam that's, I think we're seeing it with Jon Stewart and Colbert here in this country. You know, it kind of, when is it that moderates start to speak up? When they fear that they're losing the very life that they lead. And they're lazy, and you got to get them off that couch by hook or by crook. So get out there.
And I mean, you mentioned Stewart, and we were talking about this earlier, that, you know, I use a lot of Jon Stewart and The Daily Show in my classes just to talk about the media and how the media works. And Stewart has this great line in an interview maybe 7 years ago with Bill Moyers on Now, where he says, look, with 24-hour news, you don't have time for journalism. You just have time for reporting. Mm. You know, people read what's given to them rather than go out there. And again, for you, as a journalist, I mean, that must be hard to see what passes for journalism when you're actually there. And sometimes it's a very dangerous situation. Why don't you do it? Because it's hot. Because it's dangerous.
Right.
Because there's bugs. You know, the food isn't great. The lattes aren't all that nice. You know? It's much easier to sit in the hotel room, but you don't do that. You know?
No.
Is it difficult for you as a journalist to sort of see what's happening to journalism?
You know. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll tell you what's difficult is to watch opinion pass for fact. Mm. And one thing, one of the reasons that I read that tonight, and one of the reasons that it's in the book, although, you know, as all of us, I have a somewhat difficult relationship, like trying to figure out, not with my parents, I have a good relationship with them, but with myself, my own identity. But the best we can do is own our own subjectivity. You know, I don't think there is such a thing as objectivity in the news. I don't think there was either. I don't think that's distinctly different, but this veneer of objectivity, when we really just need to own who we are and why. I mean, if Glenn Beck were to say, listen, this is where I come from and this is what the agenda I'm trying to push, and so this is why I'm telling you this, I don't think that day is coming anytime soon.
No, and every news story, our top stories tonight, you know, someone decides. Story number one, story right. number two, story number three. We put that together. And I had the great privilege of having as a mentor Wilfred Cantwell Smith, you know, the great sort of Canadian scholar of religion in the 20th century. And he hated that word objectivity when we talked about human beings, because the idea was we're not dealing with objects. If I'm a scientist in studying, you know, molecules in a test tube, that's a subject. That's perfectly fine. Mm. That's an object. Human beings are subjects. They're not objects. When we start treating human beings, subjects, exactly right. as objects, we run into all sorts of problems.
No, that's exactly. I mean, this book is a really, it's a series of interwoven voices of people's stories themselves. Because one of the reasons I wrote it is that, you know, I work for primarily secular magazines. You know, you go into Harper's and editors have changed, and say, you know, I've seen people, their lives are patterned by God. They roll their eyes around. You know, come on, doesn't it boil down to money or something? It's not God. And, you know, people are not, that's one reason this word developing is just out the window. People are not developing toward our secularism. If anything, we're developing toward a greater degree of religiosity. So this is really about, well, you want to tell people that they're fighting only over land? They say to you they're fighting over God. So what are their voices, and how do we start to listen to those voices kind of whole cloth, as opposed to thinking that we somehow know better?
Absolutely. And taking religion seriously, because this country, even when we say it's secular, we don't mean it's not religious. You know, it's off the charts religious compared to Europe in terms of who reads the Bible, prays, goes to church, those kinds of things. There's no official state religion. But again, one of the things that your book points out is, what are some of those interweavings where there may not be an official state religion, but what does it mean that Franklin Graham is George W. Bush's pastor and is doing things that seem like state diplomacy, except they're not official state diplomacy, except their official state diploma. You know,
exactly.
Where's
exactly.
That intersection?
And then, I mean, you think, you know, Osama bin Laden had found safe haven for years. I hope this is not too convoluted. So he's, you know, in the 90s, he was in Sudan, right? So he rails against the Christian West, and we say, but the West isn't Christian. And, well, Franklin Graham just did statecraft there. And the person who told me about that pin in Graham's pocket, and this isn't in the book, is this man named Hassan al-Turabi, who was known as the Pope of Terrorism. He's the one who invited bin Laden to Sudan originally. I went to see him the night after this meeting between Graham and Bashir, and he wanted to show that he still had influence in the palace. So he dropped me a little crumb and said, did you know about the re-election pin? So I went wheeling back to ask Graham about it. But it was again, the host of Osama bin Laden who knew this story of the re-election pin. So these things weave and weave and weave.
It's been this tremendous privilege to have this conversation with you, but you sort of feel bad because there's other people in the room, and you might want to be part of this conversation. So we have some microphones at the back, so if you've got a question, we've got two folks that will bring microphones to you. So the lady here first.
A question for both of you about this question of the evolution away from religiosity, or, as you described, a kind of softening of moderates in Islam stepping forward to say, we are reclaiming our faith. Do you also see a corollary taking place, as it has in the West, where people have evolved to say in the Pew studies and other religiosity studies, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious, as a defining you know, a polyglot religion or a kind of personal religion. Are you seeing that in Islam as well?
Yeah. Oh, you see that all the time here with a lot of kids. And it really has to do with, you know, well, what does your Islam mean? Well, it means these poems by Rumi. It means this kind of music by Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, or that kind of music, you know, that's my music, South Asian Qawwali music. For my kids, my students, it's Lupe Fiasco. Atlanta rapper, it's Mos Def, you know, New York rapper, and it's that sense of things. And if you look at the studies about Islam, and I'm just talking about in this country, the highest level that you see is 30% of Muslims identifying with a mosque. By definition, that means 70% aren't. Now there's lots of reasons for that, one of which is, you know, you can do the kinds of things at home that you need to do, but part of it is the sense of, you know, do the mosque speak for me, or do I do my own kinds of things? So you see all sorts of interesting organizations. I on my webpage for my students, I have a list of most of the websites for most of the major North American Muslim groups. And there's, you know, Muslims for Progressive Values. You know, who knew there was a group called Muslims for Progressive Values? Queer Jihad, you know, based out of West Hollywood to say, you know, we're here, we're queer, we're Muslim. You know, that doesn't rhyme as well, but, you know. You have other Muslims that say, and again, it's exactly the Franklin Graham, you know, your dad sort of split. It's perfectly okay to be gay and a Muslim. It's sinful. That's an oxymoron.
Right.
How can you call yourself a gay Muslim? You can't be a Muslim if you're, you know, those kinds of things. So you are seeing those. There's a hand up over here, the gentleman in the yellow shirt. Sorry, she's bringing you a microphone. This is being recorded in podcast. So.
I think you've just barely touched on this a little bit between you, but I've under the impression that there's less hostility between Muslims in the United States and the powers that be than there is in Europe. Mm. Am I kidding myself about that? And if I'm not, if that what I've heard is true, how do you explain it?
Oh, it's really simple. I mean, the idea that American Muslims are an American success story. I mean, I look at myself. I was born in Pakistan. I grew up in Canada. All my education, kindergarten to PhD, is in Canada. And then I came here. Why? Because the universities here are better. There's more of them here. There's more people here, you know. And so, but I'm able to do that. I'm able to come here and work and do that. I was sort of anomalous in my Muslim settings because both my parents worked in factories. You know, the rest of my Muslim friends, their dads were doctors, lawyers, engineers, business people. And so if you look at all the studies, American Muslims are as wealthy as the wealthiest non-Muslim Americans. American Muslims are as educated as the most educated non-Muslim Americans. You know, I say this to people, if you're looking for dialogue opportunities, don't go to the mosque, go to the hospital, because you'll find some Muslim doctors there. Go to the university. You'll find some Muslim professors there. And so I think you see that here. In Britain, for example, it's very different. You know, and part of that has to do with economic realities. You know, the unemployment rate for Muslims in Britain is about three times the unemployment rate for non-Muslims in Britain. If you look at what does it mean to be an American, you know, you look out there, it depends answer. Very different than what does it mean to be British or French, you know, much more sort of homogeneous kind of thing. And then the Muslim communities are different as well. That in America, about one-third of us American Muslims are people like me, South Asians, you know. A quarter of us are African Americans. A third of us are Middle Eastern. So, you know, and then you've got converts to Islam. You've got all sorts of people from other places. So what's an American Muslim look like? It depends. In Britain, almost all the Muslims are South Asian. In France, almost all the Muslims are North African. In Germany, almost all the Muslims are Turkish. And so you don't want to stereotype, but I think there's more defined notions of what it means to be a German or an Englishman than what it means to be an American. And I think that sort of discrimination, racism that happens there, without saying that there isn't discrimination in this country, I mean, of course there is, but it's of a different sort there. So I think precisely because American Muslims are allowed to succeed here and succeed here and fit into that fabric of American life. Yeah. Question at the front.
Thank you for the conversation. This has been fascinating. Eliza, I'm curious, in the course of your travels through the 10th parallel, did you encounter any atheists? Mm. And do they play any role in these societies? And are there any powerful atheist voices like Christopher Hitchens or Sam Harris or Bill Maher?
I encountered a lot of former Marxists. Because essentially what has happened in some areas, especially, this is as true in Indonesia as it is in Somalia, is that during the Cold War, right, we had these third world battlefields where the U.S. and the Soviet Union vied for power, and people became reliant on donors. They became donor states, right? They got money from outside. With the collapse of the Cold War, the new ideology to come in has really been primarily religious. And so some of those relationships, these former Marxists, one of my favorite conversations, I don't think this is in the book because it was so just fleeting, but I spoke to the former head, basically, of the CIA of Somalia, who now, he's in exile. He's in a lot of trouble. But at this time, he was in exile. He was okay. And he was telling me that during the Cold War, they got books by Dulles, and they also got the Maoist texts sent sort of clandestinely under brown paper wrappers from rival factions. So, and now he's a staunch Islamist. Why? Because that's the quickest road to power. Because if you want to, in certain areas, if you want to shore up your authority, for example, one of the guys in the book is the son of Mohammed Farah Aidid, the warlord who shot down two American Blackhawks in Somalia in 93, like the author of Black Hawk Down. Yeah. Right? His son, a former U.S. Marine, right, is now a warlord in Somalia, was president for about 5 minutes, and is now a staunch Islamist. Now, this guy is a bit of a joker. He has some interesting ideas, and they are that, you know, the majority of North African Muslims are Sufi, and we see in this vibrant expression of experiencing God through the human heart, that here is an influence that stands up and doesn't look like what we see as Arab Islam, and that the U.S. could have a much more active role in fostering diversity within Sufism and speaking to Sufis as opposed to thinking we need to go to Mecca all the time.
Good questions. Gentleman up here.
I'm a new PhD student at Claremont, which has entered into a relationship with the Center for Islamic Studies and Jewish Studies. Do you have any comments or thoughts on the project, or as a new student and a recovering PK, any direction?
Do you want to take the PK part? Because that's
direction for recovering PKs? There's PK Anonymous. I don't know. Amir was saying that he came to theology through English, and I think I came through the other way. You were saying, right? Did I get that right?
Yeah. It's through English literature.
You know, yeah. I mean, that whole idea that I was talking about, this Eleade idea of hierophany, spaces where sacred and secular worlds meet, for me is what writing poetry is about. It's the attempt to create ceremony.
And for me, it was William Blake. You know, Professor Fry wrote, you know, the great book on Blake, Fearful Symmetry. And at the University of Toronto, Jerry Bentley, you know, phenomenal Blake scholar, and we're studying, you know, Blake's paintings. And there's Red Dragon, and well, this comes from Revelations. Well, I don't know Revelations. So you open up Revelations 12. You know, great Red Dragon, the woman clothed with the sun, and then you get to Revelations 12. I think it's line 7 or line 9 about, and there was a war in heaven, and Michael and his angels fought. And the devil and his angels fought. And I'm like, wait a minute, go back to that. There was a war in heaven, and the devil has angels? This is much more interesting story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That way. But the question about the PhD program, I think that goes to Muslims in this country, that there really isn't a way to train imams, religious leaders here. And so what you end up, what used to happen, the model was you brought in someone from the country of origin. So the South Asian community would have like a Pakistani imam or a Turkish imam or an Egyptian imam, you know, for the various communities. Then they realized that that isn't working. And so you've got people now who are sent to the home country for training and come back here. So you've got, you know, American kids who go to Mecca or wherever and come back. Except the communities are needing their imams, and for those of you who aren't familiar with imams, imams are rabbis in the sense of they're textual scholars, but the community needs them to be social workers and chaplains and to negotiate the hospital bureaucracy and to negotiate the government, the prison bureaucracy, you know, all those kinds of things. And so for me, that there's always been this push to say, look, why don't we partner with places like, as you're doing, you know, at Claremont, to say, you've already established some pretty good centers here for doing the pastoral counseling chaplain kind of work. Partner with someone that can do the Islamic studies part of it, but the communities are asking for their religious leaders not just to be textual scholars, but to be chaplains, pastors, ministers, and have that skill set. So I think that's phenomenal. There's a woman over here. She's bringing the mic down.
My question is for either of you or both of you. Where do you see Judaism and Jews fitting into this? You know, I think we have a striking issue in the Middle East, in part because of religion. And I don't know that Christianity enters into it. So I'm curious as to where do you see Judaism fitting in?
Let me start with that and turn it over to Eliza. Because, I mean, Christianity certainly does fit into it because, of course, we forget the Christianity in the Middle East there. But I think here, and again, I've had this extraordinary privilege teaching where I teach at Loyola Marymount University, that last semester we did a course called Muslim-Jewish Theology. And it was me and Rabbi Chaim Seidler-Feller, who's the Hillel director at UCLA. And again, you know, that... This ain't, you know, your typical Jesuit university. I mean, maybe it is your typical Jesuit university in that sense of you've got a Muslim and a Jew teaching a course, you know, on Muslim and Jewish theology. And it's fascinating to, because in so many ways, there are connections between Muslims and Jews. In other ways, there are connections between Muslims and Christians. And I think to bring that picture in, we didn't talk about this at all here, but this idea of Islamophobia, the sort of fear or the hatred against Islam and Muslims, you know, that's got nothing on American anti-Semitism. You know, they didn't, after 9/11, put us in internment camps like they put the Japanese in internment camps. And so I think that experience of what does it mean to be a minority? How do you deal with that? I mean, that's the Catholic history in this country. You know, I read to my students sometimes things from the Know Nothing Party, you know, who are talking about these foreigners who come to our country, who aren't Americans, who don't speak our language, who eat ridiculous foods. And they're talking about European Catholics. They're not talking about, you know, Muslims. And so I think absolutely there's some really interesting connections. Now, what gives me, and I suppose I'm an optimistic person, but what gives me hope is and I don't mean to say solipsistic, but my generation of Muslims who've grown up in North America with Jews as friends, with Jews as teachers, with Jews as colleagues, with Jews as partners, you know, in a way that's very different from other places where you may not have had that kind of experience. I think you need to have that sense of familiarity with the person before you can work with them. You have to be able to work with them as well. But Eliza, I don't know if you want to add anything.
Sure. I mean, I think we see the same contest inside of Judaism that we do inside Christianity and Islam. And we see certainly the same need for the silent majority, for moderates to speak up. And, you know, I was just talking to a Jewish friend of mine who was brought up in a conservative family, and he was saying, why is it that we don't speak up more about the radicals within Israel, right? And claim that space. I mean, we have the same things going on everywhere. And just, I mean, in terms of history, one of the most ancient Jewish communities in Africa is in Ethiopia, right? And that was one of the most fascinating elements of traveling there for me, was the story of this ancient Jewish community coming, and that, you know, the Ethiopians understand this to be this child, the love child of the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon, right? So that this, they bore a son, his name was Menelik, that he brought the Ark of the Covenant to Ethiopia, where it still is today. And there's an incredible heroic, actually I was thinking that maybe I should write about her, but I don't think I'm going to. It's this woman named Queen Judith, who's a Jewish queen, 10th century queen, who just wreaked havoc in Ethiopia. Why? Because she was like a mountain queen, and she's like Esther. I mean, she's incredible. And so her people were becoming minorities, and she was having to fight back. And I mean, it could be that the Ark of the Covenant is right now in Ethiopia, in the ancient kingdom of Aksum, and passed from Jewish to Christian hands there. So to reclaim all of these strands of history, I think is essential, and to understand that this contest inside religions is happening almost everywhere.
So, question to the gentleman over here in the blue shirt.
This is kind of an off-the-wall question, but I've been reading about some of the terrible applications of Sharia law in some of the countries in the Muslim world. And I've just wondered how much of that you have encountered.
Me?
Yeah, and you're right about that, with regard to Sudan. And
yeah, so I'll just start with a statement like that I have found extremely helpful, that is, there is no such single thing as Sharia law, right? There's no such one single code. And Reza Aslan has this great thing that he says, that if Sharia is water, right, if this law is, and then it takes the shape of whatever vessel, whatever country you put it inside of. And so one thing, I mean, I have seen countries newly adopt Sharia, both in northern Nigeria and in Indonesia and Aceh. I'm going to keep this super brief because it could get long. So what does it mean for people to reclaim a social code that they believe to be authentic? We're getting back to this same idea of an imagined pure past. We will reclaim a history and a law that is not from the West. It's not, first of all, we're actually, if we adopt Sharia, we can actually go to trial in our lifetime. We don't have to sell our house to bribe a lawyer. Like, there are cleaner ways in which Sharia actually is applied that make practical sense to people in Nigeria, for example. There are also ideal ways which have totally failed. And largely this huge outcry we saw in the northernmost third of the state, of the country, 12 of 36 states, we want Sharia. Well, its application has not delivered on its promise. And it's much less frightening than it looks to us. In fact, talking about corruption and continued corruption, one of the governors who instituted Sharia first in northern Nigeria, the governor of a place called Zamfara State, actually turns out he bribed the man whose hand he cut off. So as these things come into public understanding, Sharia becomes less attractive. It's when we seem to think we can oppose it, or that it remains this kind of utopian ideal, that it's much fuzzier. I'm not sure that was a... Aceh is super interesting, too. I'm going to leave that for those of you who buy the book.
Which will be at...
Okay, so one person over here and then a person at the front. on the fact that you're a woman and you had access to so many powerful situations in countries where we sometimes hear that women aren't given equal treatment, or what the role of the fact that you are a woman had, you think, in your travels?
Sure. Little secret of it is it's easier and safer for a woman to do much of this reporting because, first of all, when it comes to high-level access, you're getting access by the name of your publication or your institution, right? People aren't talking to a woman. They're talking to the New York Times Magazine or whatever, right? So you're going to get that same on that side of kind of high level that you need. Most dangerous is random violence. And as a woman in the middle of a place where there could be random violence, you get a kind of 15-second, when somebody looks into your car and sees you're a woman and they've got a gun and they're thinking, maybe I'll kidnap that white person, there's a moment of like, whoa, it's a woman. She's more expensive. It's ethically more complicated. And she's going to be a pain in my bottom. So for those reasons, you know, and I think also I heard somebody talking the other day just about in most of these societies, women hold power. It's behind closed doors, and it's where the deals are brokered. Who's going to marry whom? You know, all social contracts are made by women. And, you know, in Waziristan, in this place between Afghanistan and Pakistan, where I was few times I've been there. One time I went to do a story about women. It was so hot. We were lying around on these beds called charpai. I wanted to die. I thought, this is so boring. We're not eating well. I don't want to know who's a heroin addict or who's in the blood feud. I'm tired, right? Next time I'm coming back, I'm doing a story about men. The next time I came back, I did a story about men. We ate better because the men eat first, right? So we got the better food. But all they talked about is how much their guns cost. And it was so much more boring because they don't have the power. So all again, once you get inside the door, everything breaks down.
We have time for one more question. The person at the front. Just bring it down here.
Thank you. Wanted to ask if there's any contentiousness between the Sunni and Shiite divide, and whether that is responsible for a lot of the militancy now.
Nope. Do you want to talk about that?
No, I want you to.
Well, I mean, it's a depends answer. That, you know, certainly you see that in Iraq, but I think part of the reason is there's a war going on there. Not that you want to blame colonialism for everything, but in this case, you know, you look at what used to be three provinces under the Ottomans, you know, a Kurdish province, a Sunni province, and a Shia province. You make it one country, and you're going to have some issues there. Where I come from in Pakistan, unfortunately, you have horrible massacres. It's a numerically dominant Sunni country and a Shia minority. And unfortunately, sometimes it is over property and land and those kinds of things. You see that. Now, again, you don't want to be Pollyannish about it, but I think it's this country, and particularly here in Los Angeles, you've got in the world, about 15 to 20% of the world's Muslims are Shia Muslims. In North America, particularly in America, about 30% are Shia. You live in this town, and you know why. You know, the Iranian population. You know, Iranians, of course, are Jews and Baha'is and secularists, but they're also Shia Muslims. And Iraqi Shias and other Shia communities. There's been some really interesting work done here between one of the largest Shia centers and one of the large Sunni centers to say, precisely because, you know, we're here and we're getting along, let's try to export that. And, you know, the Saeed al-Kazwini, who's the Shia leader that I'm talking about, you know, has family in Iraq who are very, very influential in Iraq. And so it's really interesting to try and do those kinds of things. And it's this fascinating kind of experience where, I mean, it's a hope that American Muslims, as Sunnis and Shias, living and working together as a peaceful model, can help in other parts of the Muslim world. We need to close here, but let me do a couple of things and then ask Eliza to end by reading one of her poems. And the first thing, of course, is to thank all of you for being here. And then the second thing is to thank Eliza for being here for this wonderful, wonderful book. I also need to say that, you know, tonight's Aloud program is funded by the Righteous Persons Foundation, and we need to report back to our funders to gauge the impact of these public programs. To that end, you'll be receiving a survey by email tomorrow, and we thank you in advance for your participation. Thank you for coming. There's a wonderful reception outside. We'll be there outside. The books are for sale. But if I could ask Eliza to... I'm sorry, I'll wait till it finishes. If I could ask Eliza to end by reading the title poem here, Wide Awake Field. It's always a privilege to hear a poet read her own poem in her own voice.
Well, I just want to say thank you, because I have to be honest, it's just been a true gift to speak with you tonight, Amir. Thank you so much, and I'm so delighted to be here, so thank you. Wide Awake Field. I've never been where we are, although the grass studded with soldiers' rusted buttons says we aren't the first. The airstrips islands of cracked macadam suggest an ancient volcano. We are the volcano. We the notes sung by a creator who, if not singular, is creation, not an idea, a force. Let us tumble. Let us laugh at our grip. If these are last days, let them not catch us sleeping, but awake in this field and ready. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujakji Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and public television station KCET. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.